Hello and welcome. Before we get into this episode, I want you to listen to something.
Daddy, why can't we see the stars during the day?
Because the sun shines so bright that we cannot see them anymore.
But where do they go?
Honey, they don't go anywhere. They're still there. We just can't see them.
But why not, if they're still there?
Because the sunlight is just stronger.
But why is sunlight stronger?
Because the sun is much closer.
Closer than what?
Closer than the other stars.
The sun is a star?
Yes. Yes, it is.
How close is the sun?
You know what, sweetheart? That's a really good question. I don't know the answer. But you made me curious. Let me find out, and I'll tell you later, okay?
Promise?
I promise.
Did this conversation sound familiar? I'm sure many of you recognized yourselves, either as the child or the parent. Isn't it fascinating? The kind of questions children ask when they're exploring the world. It's that genuine curiosity that can be a pure delight, but equally annoying when we either don't have the knowledge or the time to answer them. And when life gets in the way, that promise to find out the answer can easily be broken. And when that happens, the child maybe forgets about the question, or maybe she learns that curiosity is not really rewarded. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, because although we know that curiosity drives exploration, learning, innovation, and development, we are making it harder and harder for people to stay curious. Curiosity vanishes in a world that's focused on certainty, outcomes, and answers. And the implications of that are rarely acknowledged. Not in our educational systems, not in business, and in particular not in the current race for AI adoption. But when curiosity is gone, our motivation to learn follows. Knowledge today is just a prompt away. Learning is judged by how fast it pays off. Both turn it into a transaction. It's not the same kind of learning that happens when we really want to explore a problem, when curiosity is driving us to extend learning beyond the obvious outcome. But that is exactly where continuous improvement, connecting different ideas, new perspectives, and adaptability come from. Isn't that what we call innovation? When people lose curiosity about their work, it doesn't happen overnight. It's driven by the environment we give them. When we focus on executing instead of thinking, delivering instead of developing, and performing over growing. Gallup has been measuring this for over 2 decades in global engagement surveys. The results are not encouraging. And while some people take the drop in human engagement as a signal to question the work environments we've created, others use it as an excuse to replace humans with AI. This connects to my previous episode called The Confidence Trap, because it is overconfidence at large to believe that anyone can foresee the implications of scaling the use of AI to the degree that most human work becomes redundant. I would even say it's complete arrogance and ignorance of the human capabilities that got us to this point. Now, does that mean that I'm joining the AI fear narrative? Certainly not, because fear is never a good teacher. I prefer curiosity. So just a few weeks ago, I built myself a workstream and project planner. It's a web app to organize my entire work, running only on my laptop. I built it using Claude Code. I'd read about vibe coding before, but now I wanted to see whether someone like me, without a technical background, could actually build something real with AI. And my curiosity, despite some frustrations and a serious learning effort, was highly rewarded. The app runs on over 4,700 lines of code. It does exactly what I needed to do, and finishing it just felt amazing and almost unbelievable. What I did not expect was that building it would also take me over 30 years back in time. It was 1995. As I wanted to improve my English, I had convinced my parents to finance a school year abroad, and I went to the UK. Their A-level system allowed me to pick specific focus subjects. So, alongside economics and French, I picked computer science. I got my first computer at 13. Of course, I had used it primarily to play games, but I was also interested in how it worked. Signing up for that class simply meant following my curiosity. So, while I was still fascinated by how well my app worked, I was taken back to my first day in class. The moment of entering the room is still a scene burned into my memory. It was the looks that I got from the teacher and the other students. Yes, I was the only girl. And the whole room communicated something immediately. You do not belong here. The teacher even said, "This is the computer science class. Are you sure you're in the right room?" Not very inviting or encouraging, right? I'm sure you can imagine how well the classes went. It's easy to exclude someone from learning, but I'm not someone to give up quickly. Calling Germany from the UK in 1995 wasn't cheap, but my uncle had studied information technology and was quite computer savvy. He was the one person able to help me understand what I wasn't getting in class. So I called him, not just once. Every time I would very quickly explain what I was working on, write down everything he said, go back to the study room, work on it, and call again if I still didn't get it. I was eager to stay, but it was certainly tough. So one day we had to present homework. I don't really remember what it was exactly, a number we had to figure out or some kind of logic problem. But what I do remember vividly is this. With the help of my uncle, I had come up with a number that was different from everyone else's. And it was the correct one. I was the only one in the class who got it right. For a moment, I felt some hope, but the looks on everyone's faces quickly destroyed it again. So if you think that was the moment things shifted, that getting it right would somehow change how I was seen and treated, it didn't. If anything, it made things worse. After 2 months of receiving that continuous message of "you don't belong here," I changed to history because it was the only class with a space left. So definitely not my choice, and I had a hard time developing a strong enough interest in the Ottoman Empire to get a decent grade. In the confidence trap, we looked at what happens when we reward performative confidence too much. But I deliberately left something out of that episode. The way confidence gets taken away from others. Curiosity builds our drive to learn, but we also need encouragement to sustain it. Without it, the courage to keep going is easily destroyed. What I experienced in 1995 was not unusual. The same certainty that inflates the confidence of some people is also being used to tell others they are not enough, and at worst, to exclude them. This happens in classrooms, in teams, and in entire workplaces. Go back in time yourself now. Think of the best teacher you ever had, someone whose influence you still carry. Just hold that memory for a moment, and let's look at what curiosity actually is. Considering our childhood nature and how we learn, I would say it's a fundamental part of human nature, a trait we all carry when we enter this world. It certainly holds an intrinsic motivation, and from an adult perspective, we may be inclined to say that some people have more of it than others. But just let me guess a little bit what your teacher was like. They probably didn't just give you facts and figures and didn't hand you the answer. I'm sure they asked questions that weren't just focused on one solution. Rather, they made not knowing feel like the start of something, something you wanted to explore and figure out yourself. They inspired you to think across subjects and to connect the dots. That is the best form of teaching. It's the ability to empower our innate curiosity. So curiosity isn't just a trait. If it gets nurtured by great teachers, it becomes a skill. A skill that defines whether we consider learning something finite or infinite. And that's what most organizations get wrong. They treat it like a trait instead of a skill. Research on learning consistently shows that people become more curious when they're given problems worth thinking about, when their questions are taken seriously, when they feel safe enough to make mistakes and to keep learning. Curiosity needs a gap, something we don't know yet but want to know. That gap is the engine of learning. If we close it too fast by handing people the answer, by punishing mistakes and questions, and leaving the thinking to whoever speaks the loudest, we kill the very thing that makes learning possible. And we have built entire environments that did exactly that long before AI arrived. AI is in many ways just amplifying the conditions that are already given. And it's striking to see people building something that risks destroying the very qualities that got us this far. History is full of inventor and tinkerer stories that show us exactly why curiosity is a skill to be nourished and developed. In the 1840s, Ada Lovelace looked at a mechanical calculating engine and saw something others were missing. She didn't just see a tool to calculate faster. She asked what else could be done with it. Eventually, she described what computers could do a century before they existed. At the age of 27, with no formal scientific position, but with a question she couldn't let go of. Nikola Tesla did not invent things by following a plan. He played with ideas compulsively, without knowing where they were going. Most of what he tried didn't work. He kept going anyway. The alternating current that powers most of the world's electricity today came from someone who simply wouldn't stop asking what electricity could do. Neither of them was chasing a deliverable or optimizing for output. They were following their curiosity. So leaders building environments where learning is only valued by its direct impact on performance are hollowing out their organization. The pattern I've repeatedly seen is that when profits drop, the first budget to get cut is learning and development. And the reasoning is almost always the same. It's the hardest to connect to immediate return and the easiest to explain away. But every time it happens, curiosity and learning take another hit. The message to employees is quiet but clear. Your development is costs, not investment. The organizations that will sustain know something different. They know that investing in people is the future. And that investment is not only about training and development budgets, but about an entire culture built on the genuine belief that people are the reason the business exists. It's a culture where curiosity is valued, where someone can say, "I don't know yet," safely, where learning happens daily and not because it's in the calendar. It's an environment and leadership culture that continuously supports it. So the way curiosity is being treated in an organization eventually tells us way more than any culture statement on a company website. Two companies got this right long before AI was making headlines. In 2005, Delta Airlines filed for bankruptcy. The US airline industry was on its knees after 9/11. Pressure to cut everything was enormous. Delta cut costs too, but they did not cut the belief that their people were the reason their business existed. So CEO Ed Bastian, then still in the role of CFO, didn't just look at the numbers. He got curious about the people running the business. So he started gathering up to 300 employees at a time for listening sessions called Velvet. Velvet as in behind the velvet rope. 20 years later, those sessions still happen. 1,000 frontline employees still come behind that rope every year. And he didn't stop at listening. Delta also runs a program called Behind the Wings. Senior leaders volunteer to do the frontline jobs themselves. They sit behind baggage drop desks, at ticket counters. They deal with frustrated customers and cold mornings on the ramp. And starting in 2020, Delta rebuilt its career framework. Apprenticeship programs, internal promotions before external hires, a talent architecture that lets people see what they could become next. All of it driven by a CEO who was genuinely curious about what his people needed to do their best work. Take care of your people, and they take care of customers. And happy customers reward you with loyalty. Delta has been building that for 20 years. Lego, the Danish toy company, went through something similar. When Jürgen Knudstorp became CEO in 2004, the company was on the brink of bankruptcy, a victim of overexpansion and lost brand identity. He was an outsider, a former McKinsey consultant, and the first CEO not from the founding family. The first thing he did was get curious. He walked through the organization asking questions. What does it actually mean to work at Lego? What is it that we do better than anyone else? Why does this company exist? He sent his designers to live with families for a week just to watch how children played. He wanted to understand what Lego was before he tried to fix it. With this approach, he turned the company into one of the most valuable toy brands in the world. So, two different industries and countries, but two leaders with the same curiosity and belief in the people running the business. These companies got it right, but they still seem to be the exception. Most companies went the opposite direction. And now AI enters the stage. Deloitte recently published research that should stop every leader already playing the headcount reduction with AI game. Organizations are spending 93% of their budgets on AI technology, just 7% on the people expected to use it. And only 10% of organizations say that they are seeing meaningful return on that investment. So I'm wondering, is that overconfidence in AI technology or underestimation of human capabilities? Most likely it's both, because the math clearly shows it doesn't add up. And it's not as if leaders haven't been told. BCG is just one consulting company which advises the opposite. When companies undertake AI transformation, they need to focus 2/3 of their efforts on people-related capabilities. And even more interesting, the companies that actually lead in AI adoption follow this rule. 10% of resources on AI models, 20% on the infrastructure and data to run them, and 70% on people and how they work with it. Most organizations, however, stick to the high invest in technology, low invest in people approach. That is the current reality of AI adoption at the organizational level. But what happens to us individually? Do we have a choice of how much we use the new shiny tools? According to some headlines about companies forcing employees to use AI for higher productivity, probably not. Earlier this month, Time magazine published research on nearly 2,000 working adults. The study was not asking whether people used AI. It was asking how they used it. People who accepted AI outputs without questioning them, who took the first answer and moved on, reported lower confidence in their own thinking, leading to a weaker sense that the work was still theirs. People who pushed back, who edited, questioned, rejected, who stayed in the driver's seat, reported the opposite. More confidence, stronger ownership. And the most important detail, the people most likely to push back on AI were the ones with existing expertise, which means the people most at risk are the ones still developing. The junior team member who does not yet have the knowledge to recognize when AI is wrong. The new hire who doesn't have sufficient background on the company yet, or the person who never really was encouraged to think for themselves. We have already stripped entire generations of the experience of figuring something out for themselves. And now we're handing them tools that will not only kill their curiosity entirely, but take their confidence and ambition right with it. So the risk of what we are losing right now can hardly be ignored. Still, the race for artificial general intelligence continues at full speed. Consider OpenAI's definition of AGI, systems that will outperform humans at most economically valuable work. It comes as no surprise that people are already fighting AI adoption. Why would anyone want to make use of something that will eventually make them redundant? The idea that people will adapt, that we will find purpose in other things, and that universal basic income will provide, is one of the most reckless assumptions being made today. It's clearly overconfidence in the light of the power dynamics and wealth accumulation already running this world. And the people most confident we can handle this are not even the ones who built the technology. Geoffrey Hinton, one of the founding figures of modern AI, left a senior position at Google in 2023. The reason? He wanted to be able to speak freely about what could go wrong if the use of AI is focused on mere profit extraction rather than extending human capabilities. Yoshua Bengio, another key architect of deep learning, has spent years advocating for safety measures. He also asks for slowing the race down, for looking at the second and third order consequences before they become irreversible. They are not outsiders, and just two of the many critical voices among those who built the technology. And they are clearly not the ones saying full speed ahead. However, their voices sound more and more alarming, and maybe that's necessary to reach the people holding the strings. But it doesn't help learning. The attention economy pulls them into the fear narrative. The more alarming the headline, the more clicks, the more followers, and revenue. A whole content industry is now using these voices to profit before that revenue stream is also done. Instead of raising awareness and educating, they're running on drama and fear. But fear does not inspire curiosity. It leads us into paralysis. If you genuinely believe AI is coming for your job, regardless of what you do, why would you stay curious about how to work with it well? Why would you invest in learning? Why would any organization invest in developing its people? And it is becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. Fear creates paralysis. Paralysis lowers engagement. Disengagement hurts performance. And then companies see replacing human workers as the only way out. So what we actually need is the opposite. We need people curious enough to ask the hard questions, engaged enough to care about the answers, and willing to stay in the discomfort of not knowing yet. The complexity of our brains is still being mapped. We don't even have a full definition of human intelligence. Yet we behave as if we know everything. What we seem to have forgotten is that we got this far by refusing to accept that the answer in front of us is the final one. So how much overconfidence does it take to think that we can hand our thinking to machines without looking carefully at what we're trading away? Why do we talk about capabilities, growth, and innovation when we don't even understand the conditions that made those things possible in the first place? Just think about what we actually see in most companies. The person who has a better idea of doing something but doesn't say it because they're too far down in the hierarchy. The new joiner, full of ideas, who learns within a few weeks to keep their head down because someone tells them that's just the way we do things here. And the experienced manager, who used to ask great questions but stopped when told to focus on cutting costs. None of them chose to stop being curious. The environment made curiosity too costly for them. And when we introduce AI into such an environment, we certainly don't bring it back. Instead, we amplify the conditions that already reduced it. So, what should the playbook for empowering humans with AI actually look like? I would say we need leaders with the courage to hit the pause button, to sit with the second and third order consequences before we race past them. Leaders who see people as the reason their business exists, and AI as a tool to expand our capabilities, not to replace them. And we need organizations and leaders we can trust. Arrogance and overconfidence don't build trust. Curiosity and care about people do. In the reflection episode on Friday, I will give you the practices that drive your own curiosity and help you inspire it in others. If you found this episode a bit more provocative, good. I care about the future of human work. I've never lost my curiosity, but seeing it vanish more and more, sometimes even deliberately destroyed, is something I'm willing to fight against. Not by going against technology, but against the fear narrative, and against the promise that AI will eventually help us to solve the problems that we haven't even tried to solve without it. We have to bring back our curiosity, our willingness to learn and grow, and the humility to accept that we don't know everything. We should consider that we got this far with way more capabilities than what AI is currently built on, because it is built on a fragmented idea of human intelligence. And maybe it's time to become more curious about humans again. So stay curious, stay tuned. Feel free to connect with me. Hit the subscribe button and return for the reflection episode on Friday. Let me close this episode by continuing the story with which it started.
Hey, Claude. My daughter just asked me why we cannot see the stars during the day. Can you give me a child-appropriate explanation? I only told her that the sun is closer than any other star. She is 7, almost 8. Can you turn it into a bedtime story?
Of course I can help you with that. Here is a bedtime story. I called it My Friend the Little Star.
Honey, do you remember the question you asked about the stars today?
Yes, you promised you would find out how close the sun is.
I did, and I can tell you an amazing story.